Music from ABBA, and I do. Five I do's in the song title. It's 18 and a half minutes after the hour on this Friday morning. We're Broken Road Radio, and I'm Jim Park. David Allen Punt is with us, and joining us now from, technically, Don, are you in Garden Valley right now? I know you're
cheering. I'm in Mount Sylvan.
Mount Sylvan, Texas, which is probably a suburb of Garden Valley, Texas, or vice versa.
Well, yeah, it's a kind of a suburb of Tyler, Texas, where... Mount Sylvan's about 10 miles from where I live.
Mm-hmm. And how far away how far away is Tyler then?
Well, it's about 20 miles from here.
Okay, because Tyler's a name I know. I think there's some famous ball players from Tyler, Texas.
Well, like there's famous singers, famous ball players.
Yeah.
This is East Texas. We have a lot of famous people.
Texas contributes its share. Dr. Don is a biochemist and member of the board at Creation Moments. And we talk about science versus faith issues here, and creation versus evolution, and things connected with that. And Dr. Don brought to our attention an article. You can read about it over on nature.com. It talks about a mysterious radiation burst that has been recorded in tree rings. And it dates back to about, 774, 775 A.D. And Don, what makes this significant? Why is this event significant, and how do they date it so precisely?
Well, by counting the tree rings and assuming that each ring in the tree represents, you know, a change in season, which in this case, in most cases, should be a yearly cycle. And what's interesting, so that's where they got the date. It's in the 775 AD growing season. That's where they found the burst of carbon-14.
So this was this was back in the period of time when Charlemagne was active in Europe, defending it against the Moors from the south, and forcing people to turn Christian. And just before the Vikings got started, just to give us a sense in our timeline of the things that were happening then, and this mysterious burst of radiation. Is that an assumption, or do they know that it had to come from outer space? Is the only source for this the sun or other bodies out there?
Yes, the way carbon-14 is actually formed is from gamma rays basically bombard nitrogen-14, which is the naturally occurring nitrogen in our atmosphere. And then that produces neutrons, which then eventually hit the carbon-12, which then, produces, nitrogen then produces carbon-14. So you get carbon-14 from nitrogen-14 with the bombardment of radiation from outer space.
And how does this tree ring exhibit a difference? What's different about that tree ring?
Well, it had more carbon-14 in it than it should have had. So things weren't quite in equilibrium that year, and there had to be more radiation from outer space in order to create more carbon-14, which the tree absorbed during that year.
So they would recognize the difference in that year because the tree rings on either side of it would have been either more normal or different significantly.
Right, and I think they measured, you know, multiple tree rings for the carbon-14. Actually, they probably had to dissect the whole thing in order to be able to, you know, draw any conclusions that this is out of the ordinary. You might have some year-to-year fluctuation, but not as much as what was actually found for this particular year. So they said, well, gee, this is a very interesting find. This kind of means that there was a lot of some type of either a tremendous solar flare that happened either the prior year or right near that year, or a supernova that exploded, but history didn't record any bright, either a bright, very, very bright star that you would be able to see. If it was a supernova, you would be able to see that during the day. And
I would presume, as intently as skies were watched by people all around the world, that something would have been noticed and written had that been visible anyway. But there's a lot of invisible radiation, too. I don't know how people would have been equipped to track that down or to detect it back then. Would this burst of energy have made a difference to people's lives on Earth?
Well, if it was that strong, which it had to be, you know, very strong in order to create the amount of carbon 14 that increase that they saw. So, I mean, it wasn't a time when they had radio, for example.
Mm-hmm.
If they had radio, I'm sure radio waves would have been disrupted. And
well, of course, we get warnings in radio now. FM radio stations see warnings every year about solar outbursts. They happen regularly on a cycle, and so we get notifications to expect interference. But, of course, that wouldn't have been available to them. But would they have seen, say, Northern Lights?
Oh, Northern Lights would have been tremendous, you know, if it was indeed a solar flare, because, you know, that's, you would see an increase in, obviously, in the Northern Lights with an increase of radiation coming from out of space, in particular from the sun. So they could have seen, you know, Northern Lights, those folks that lived, you know, more northerly, obviously, Eskimos and folks like that. But it doesn't appear.
Don, we're losing you again. We're losing contact.
It was recorded that year.
Okay, we're getting just intermittent bursts of audio here, Don. Let's.
All right, can you hear me now? Let me turn off my video.
Mm-hmm.
And see what that
does. See if
does.
That improves things a little bit here.
Okay, my video is off. How's my audio?
Okay, it sounds good for the moment here. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's leave
the video off.
Any other ways they could have detected this? Would it have affected plant growth or farming or anything of that nature that the general population would have been aware of this?
I don't think so. I don't know if it was that strong that you know, folks would have gotten, let's say, had more cases of sunburn, mm-hmm. for example, that year, but they you know, they might have. People weren't necessarily attuned to the types of things that we're attuned to today, and certainly didn't have the instrumentation that we have today for monitoring what's going on in space, for example. You get telescopes, but
did the Earth maybe have better protection then?
That was,
you know, in terms of the ozone layer or some other protective device, would such a radiation burst today, for example, affect our health differently than it might have back then?
That brings up another subject, which we can get into today, which is the magnetic field strength around the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And the higher the magnetic field strength, the more we're protected from radiation from out of space. And back then, there would have been, a little stronger magnetic field around the Earth. The magnetic field has been decreasing, really, for a number of years. They've actually have accurate measurements going back 150 years. And that might have protected things, you know, a little bit, but it would, for all practical purposes, I mean, whatever event this was, you know, we would probably, you know, experience it the same, you know, today.
And this is based on research by a Japanese scientist, and it's been confirmed by American researchers, for example, Daniel Baker at the University of Colorado's Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics in Boulder. He says some very energetic event occurred about AD 775, and if it injected or caused a large increase in carbon 14 in that particular year, how might that have affected? Well, there could be other years this has happened. Don't scientists in doing carbon dating assume a certain continuous level of carbon 14 all through history?
Well, that's one of the basic assumptions, and the real question is, is that assumption correct? Which kind of brings us to our second topic. If you have fluctuations like this, then obviously the carbon 14 levels are not constant throughout history. But one of the things that affects carbon 14 production even more is, as I introduced it a little earlier, is the magnetic field around the Earth. Now, it's known that it's decreasing rapidly, and has been at least since accurate measurements over 150 years. And if one looks at the magnetic properties of iron embedded into lava that obviously has been hardened, you actually see that some time ago that the magnetic field around the Earth actually fluctuated, and that the magnetic poles actually reversed. And so what does that mean for what's going on with carbon-14 is that as the magnetic field decreases, more carbon-14 is being produced. As the magnetic field increases, then that produces a protective barrier around the Earth. And it looks like these tremendous fluctuations in the magnetic field, in the magnetic field energy, the energy has actually slowly or rapidly decreased from what appears to be the creation of the Earth. And then there was a significant drop in the magnetic field energy at the time of Noah's flood, and that's when all of these fluctuations in the magnetic field are seen.
So that would indicate if the magnetic field now is decreasing, whether sporadically or steadily, that there would be an increase in carbon-14, correct?
That's correct. So if you assume that the carbon-14 levels that we have today were constant throughout history, then what is that going to produce? That's going to produce results that says, well, gee, take the case of the whales we were talking about with the soft tissue, where they did some carbon-14 dating. It looks like the tissue is 30,000 years old or 40,000 years old. Well, you're going to overestimate the age of of the whales.
Well, let's review the process just a little bit here, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if they're measuring carbon-14 levels in order to ascertain the date of something, the less carbon-14 in it, the older it would be, correct? Because of the half-life. It keeps disintegrating, disappearing. Is that correct?
That's correct. Actually, let's review the process. I mean, actually, when an animal or a plant dies, then it stops absorbing carbon-14. It stops absorbing carbon, period. So you've got carbon-12 and carbon-14. And so if you look at the ratio of the carbon-14 to carbon-12, then that ratio, assuming everything that the rate of degradation is is constant, and you're assuming a constant level of carbon-14, in the atmosphere at the time of death, then theoretically, I mean, you should be able to predict the age of the plant or the animal, when it died.
But if from year to year that plant or animal has been absorbing a varying amount of carbon-14, that would pretty well scotch any hope of an accurate timing or an accurate aging, wouldn't it?
Well, if it if the carbon-14 has been fluctuating, it's really only the carbon-14 at about the time of its death, because we are constantly absorbing CO2, we're absorbing carbons through eating plants, for example, and eating the cellulose, or not the cellulose, but the starches and the sugars in the plants, and so we metabolize that, and then that ultimately goes into CO2 as we expire, and mm-hmm. and so we are constantly, if you will, fixing carbon in our bodies, and that's turning over rather rapidly. So the carbon-14 that's in our bodies is approximately the amount that we have absorbed during this year, for example. It's not from previous years. So that's why you can say well, gee, it looks like, you know, Don passed away 10 years ago because of this much carbon-14 in his system, just to give you an example. Okay. But the problem, of course, with the carbon-14, you know, dating is well, this is the article we were talking about earlier demonstrates that you can have fluctuations in the amount of carbon-14. It, you know, might go up and might go down. That's one problem. And so not knowing what that fluctuation is, it's, you know, it's difficult to correct your dating scale, for example, and say, oh, okay, well, you know, we need to take that into account. The other problem, though, is in a bigger problem, is this decreasing magnetic field that we've had around the Earth, and the fluctuation in the magnetic field and the magnetic field reversals that we've had, that could be and probably was affecting the level of carbon-14 tremendously. So you can look at it kind of this way, and I like to look at it this way from the point of view that when God created the heavens and the earth, and he created everything perfectly, and so he created an environment for us that was protected from space radiation, if you will. And so the magnetic field around the earth was strong enough to prevent any carbon-14 formation, you know, at the time of creation. Now, of course, when Adam and Eve fell, then things started to change, and then the magnetic field started to degrade, and then that allowed radiation to start striking the Earth and start producing carbon-14, and so doing any type of carbon-14 measurements at very, very low levels cannot tell you that something is, let's say, 40 or 50,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the carbon-14 levels at the beginning of, the Earth, for example, 6,000 years ago, was zero or very, very low, then you're going to overestimate tremendously the time of, let's say, people who lived before the flood. If you could, you know, if you found skeletons of people who lived before the flood and carbon dated them, you would think that they're much, much older than they actually are.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering now about the last step of the procedure. If once the level of carbon-14 is determined for a given formerly living body, do they then have like benchmarks for this amount of carbon-14 so that they could relate it to a specific era, or is it just simply a quantitative decision based on how much carbon-14 there is?
No, it's right now. I don't think their models are sophisticated enough to take into account this decreasing magnetic field effect that I just described.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the simplest assumption is, well, carbon-14 levels have been constant throughout history, and so therefore, you know, we can assume that the starting carbon-14 was this level, in any amount that any ratio that we're measured is due to time.
So I'm thinking that in continuing this research on this particular aspect, that they would be looking at tree rings from that same period over maybe a larger portion of the Earth to determine if the same increase in carbon-14 happened there. Do you know if that kind of work is going on? Would that be a logical next step for these researchers?
Well, they should go back and study other tree rings. I mean, let's take trees that are 4,000 plus years old, which actually would put the tree at the time of the flood, by the way.
Yeah.
So we don't really have any trees older than that in existence these days.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go back at least 4,000 years and measure the carbon-14 levels in each of the tree rings. and say, oh, gee, you know, we've had fluctuations, you know, in this year and that year, and start plotting that data. And that would be a very interesting study, you know, to do. And, you know, just to see, and I don't know if anyone has done that detailed a level of a study, because when they were initially setting up the carbon 14, they probably took like, you know, every 100 years, we'll take a carbon 14 sample. Well, analyzing carbon 14 these days is a lot more accurate than it was back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Or earlier, and so we've got instruments that can really detect very, very low levels and very accurately. To go back and look at every tree ring, I mean, it would be tedious, but it is doable.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we've seen in science, and we've talked about this before, how anything that militates against the established viewpoint, in this case, that carbon dating is an accurate way to measure up to what, 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 years of age, that this research may never see the light of day, no matter what it discovers. Is that a possibility?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. If it goes against the grain of of popular, you know, science, then unfortunately, some of that, you know, may not come to the light, at least to the popular light. It's certainly not going to hit the mainstream media. But you might find the work at a conference, for example, that we talked about with, I think it was the whales, that the amount of carbon 14 in the whales, or the I don't remember now whether it was the piece of wood that was found in the volcanic rock. Mm-hmm. That was perfectly preserved.
You'd think this is the kind of information that would excite scientists all over the world. They'd have to look at it.
Yeah, and say, well, maybe our thinking is wrong. I mean, maybe we need to rethink this. But, you know, unfortunately, science, like any branch, physical sciences or chemical sciences or, you know, radio science in this case, we come with our presuppositions. And a lot of times those presuppositions can lead us astray to wrong conclusions. Not that the data is wrong, it's that our interpretation of the data, is wrong based on what our presupposition is.
Well, this is fascinating, and it will be interested to see if there's a follow-up a project to substantiate or refute the findings here, and how that might affect the whole outlook on carbon 14 dating. But we mentioned the opposition from science in political issues. You know, the same thing happens wherever popular opinion tends to be, or where the money lies, tends to oppose science in so many big cases. I'm thinking now of the genetic engineering. The issue of a genetically engineered or genetically modified foods, particularly corn and soybeans. We talked about that a few weeks ago. And I've noticed that with respect to, I think it's Proposition 37 in California, where there's a ballot measure that folks will be voting on next Tuesday that might, if passed, would require food manufacturers to label genetically engineered products or ingredients in their products. And it's engendered a whole wave of some very vituperative opposition from folks who don't seem to be so concerned with the science. In fact, I'm not sure what the concern is, how they can argue against this proposition. Don, are you up to speed on that that Proposition 37? Do you know what's going on out there?
Well, I don't know if it's 37 or 39. Maybe Dave can be looking that up. to make
Google
sure
Meister
we have the accurate
double check.
The accurate information, but it's basically just a proposition that says, hey, look, folks, we want to know what's in our food since we are eating it, and we've heard some negative things about genetically modified, especially corn, but soybeans, and I guess there's rice and various other grains and products out there. That we want to have the choice of either, you know, purchasing this product or not.
Yeah, there have been some warnings that have gone out on rice. I guess it's mercury levels, something like that, in just about all forms of rice produced these days. That's a concern. I'm looking at the article we covered. It's on the Mercola.com website, articles by Dr. Mercola. And it's about genetically engineered corn and soy, and refers to a 10-year study out of Norway that indicates this is simply not healthy. It is Proposition 37.
Okay. And, all right. Very good.
And I'm now linking to an article that talks about some of the opposition and the grounds upon which they're opposing this ballot proposition.
Well, the only grounds that the opposition has, I mean, is that it was one of economics. In the first argument is going to be, well, we're going to have to go back and relabel all of our products. So the manufacturers of cereals, for example. Or all of these foodstuffs that are made from genetically modified materials, which is most of them these days, mm-hmm. we're going to have to go back and relabel.
Well, that doesn't seem to be too intimidating to me. I mean, they do that anyway. They change colors, change names. They print
exactly.
new labels frequently.
Exactly. So, they're using it as this is going to cost so much money. Mm-hmm. Well, had they labeled them properly in the beginning, then it wouldn't have cost them any more money, and it's not going to cost them, you know, that much more money because, as you said, they're changing packaging designs constantly, and so, you know, let the current product go through the consumer, and then any new products that you're introducing, you just have the new label on it. It's not that big a deal. Labeling does have to be approved by the FDA. Yes, I know that, but. Even so, it's like one of these things that the only thing that you're changing is saying that these ingredients are genetically modified.
Well, the real fear must be that people will buy less genetically modified product if they see that labeling. That's got to be the assumption here.
That's exactly right. And that's where the fight is. It's not so much from the manufacturers of the cereal, for example, breakfast food cereals, or other products made from these genetically modified foods. It's actually by the companies that have designed the genetically modified products in the first place.
And indeed, that seems to be where the opposition to Prop 37 is coming from universities and research firms that are heavily invested in biotech.
Right. So These companies are saying, wait a minute, we're going to be fighting for our lives. I mean, we've held this type of labeling back from the public for years. And now if this proposition passes, what happens, especially in things like this in California, will ultimately sweep through throughout the country, which is a good thing for consumers, a bad thing for such mega giants as Monsanto, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, this article is on Mercola.com, Mercola. It's after Dr. Mercola's name, and it certainly has a bias against genetically engineered products. I mean, you'll find that throughout the website, but still fascinating reading, and you can always track down some of the claims by following up with further searches on scientists' names and university names and so forth, so you can verify this or refute it with your own research. But interesting article over at Mercola.com on Prop 37. That'll be an interesting thing to hear the results from next Tuesday. Talking with Dr. Don Clark of CreationMoments.com. Doc, a biochemist, and he normally joins us on Monday mornings, and we'll look forward to hearing you again this next Monday morning. Maybe we can take a further look at that magnetic field variation and how that might affect life on Earth and affect the way compasses move and any health ramifications of that. It'd be an interesting discussion. David has a question. David, David, your audio's off though.
Well, I got to do everything. Push my buttons.
David, you have one button.
I just had the one thing before, just pushing the button, but then I had to raise my hand. You know that, so that
multitasking.
It's a multitasking thing. Yeah, genetically modified organisms. It reminds me of the country of origin debate a couple of years ago, where meat producers were dragging their heels about allowing labels on meat products that would say where the meat came from, and it seems to have the same specious arguments. That this will cause people to say, oh my gosh, I don't want to buy beef from Chile, or I certainly wouldn't want to buy shrimp from Thailand. You know, they have horrible shrimp there. But that doesn't make any sense. There's no question about quality. And Russia has banned GMO organisms for a time. I'm not sure if that ban has been lifted or not. Do you know, Don?
No, I'm not sure. But Europe is certainly against genetically modified products. Germany, in particular, hasn't allowed them. From the very beginning.
Yeah, and it almost seems like there must be such incredibly much amount of money or a large amount of money involved for these organizations, these companies, to be concerned about losing a market edge. And it wouldn't be a market edge, you know, at the present time. There's no alternative. I mean, there isn't, you know, if there's something like 90-95% of the grocery stores filled with genetically modified organisms of one form or another, what's the other choice? There is no other choice.
Well, your only other choice is organic, mm-hmm. Certified organic, to make sure that the GMO is not in the, in the product. Now, if there is a demand, ultimately it will be supplied, by the farmer, and he will start, growing non-genetically modified corns and grains again.
Mm-hmm.
Until that time, we're going to see, our products at least continuing to be genetically modified. Now, I might also add that there is a growing interest in organic foods.
Mm-hmm.
And so that market is growing.
Don, I've got to ask, what percentage of this genetic engineering is an outcrop of the need for Roundup and maybe other pesticides? Is that the essential reason for the modifications?
For corn, for example, and for soybeans, corn was modified to be able to withstand Roundup, which is obviously a herbicide. So if you're spraying your fields with a herbicide to kill the weeds, and the herbicide gets on your corn, then it will kill it. But Monsanto came up with this super corn that can withstand Roundup. So we've now have this corn that the farmers can just go in and spray Roundup. Their corn will survive and they'll have a great corn crop. The problem is that it causes both the Roundup as well as the genetically modified corn is causing a problem in our food chain.
What kind of, are there studies, definitive studies, or developing studies? And the studies haven't gone on long enough yet. I know, I realize that's one of the problems, but are there good solid indications that there are specific problems being caused?
Well, there was this Norwegian study that took 10 years to complete that does indicate that the genetically engineered foods creates a predisposition to obesity and other problems, which we are in fact seeing in large numbers across the population. I don't know if it's equally true in Europe, where these genetically engineered foods are banned, or at least portions of Europe. We see it here in the U.S. Whether or not we can attribute to genetically engineered foods yet, I'm not sure we're that confident yet, are we, Don?
Oh, I think we can. I mean, I don't think the industry, the genetically engineered industry, is ready to accept that, and they're certainly fighting hard to suppress that type of information. But I think there's enough scientific evidence that these products are not as healthy as or not innocuous. Let me put it that way, as we were originally told that they were. Also, there have been studies down in Chile that have shown that Roundup, or at least its major component, glyphosate, causes birth defects, and so we're seeing a wide range of negative activity, or not activity, but results from the use of these products. And we need to use caution And I applaud the folks in California for even putting this, to the populace for voting, because why, as consumers, should we not know this information?
It's hard to argue against knowing what you're buying.
Yeah, exactly.
and especially with what appear to be specious arguments and obviously prompted by economic self-interest in the case of the big chemical companies, Monsanto in particular. We'll watch this with interest next Tuesday. And Dr. Don, as always, appreciate having you on the air and giving us an authoritative sense of what's happening in the world of science and nature. CreationMoments.com is a website you might want to explore. You can link to it from our website at BrokenRoadRadio.com over on the right-hand side of the page, and they have a wealth of information and resources for you and for your church. Dr. Don, be blessed, and we'll talk to you Monday, okay?
Very good. We'll see you again.
Good to see you, Don.
All right. Bye-bye.
Music from Keith Cooper.